The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton. Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. De Boer sacked, Roy Hodgson primed to take over. Mane's high kick, the red card that has divided the nation. The first handshake gate of the season as Stoke hold Manchester United. Spurs remind Everton that they'll finish seventh and Brighton score a goal. Elsewhere, Real are held at home again. Sid will explain all. Plus a European roundup, your questions and feedback corner. Put it all together and it's today's Football Weekly. Joining me on this journey through football, Barry Glendenning, lovely to see you.
And to see you, lovely.
Jonathan Wilson, how are your feet?
Really, really sore, thank you.
You sort of came in with a Kaiser Soze type limp.
Yeah, my arthritis is not good at the moment.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Barney Rone, first pod of the season.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. There's something, I don't know, something's changed. There's a sort of lightness in the air. We're springing in all our steps except Wilson's. I don't know what it is. I'll think at some point.
When you finally work it out, yeah. Anytime.
It's nice though.
You can just say anything. Well, you're very welcome. So let's start with that news, which strangely for the pod has happened while we're recording and not just after we've finished recording. Frank de Boer has been sacked. Our London football correspondent is Dom Fifield. All right, Dom, how are you doing?
Not too bad, Max.
So tell us what's happened.
Well, the inevitable, really. Not inevitable on yesterday's performance against Burnley when Palace actually played their best football of the season and looked more comfortable in the system that suited them, but inevitable because of the breakdown in relationship between De Boer and Steve Parish. See, breakdown's probably not the right word because I suppose you have to have a relationship first before anything can actually break down, and I'm not sure they ever had it. It's just been the wrong fit from day one, really. And that is a damning indictment of Palace's due diligence in the summer, of the appointment process that went on for a month, involved over 30 candidates being scrutinised. They ended up with Frank de Boer. Allegedly, Frank de Boer promised one thing and delivered another. He was promising evolution, not revolution. He definitely came in with revolution on his mind. It hasn't worked. They haven't got the players to play the way that Frank de Boer wanted. Then to play, and the club doesn't feel as if it's ready for something like that. The squad doesn't feel ready. And it's been a disaster waiting to happen. And really, today's news has been on the cards since the team sheet went in against Swansea City before the international break. And the results have been dismal. Haven't scored a goal yet. Panic has set in the boardroom, and they've acted.
Who's being lined up? I did a radio show with Sam Allardyce about 4 days ago, who was like, oh, it's a bit too soon for me. I'd rather it in February. And I saw rumours this morning about Roy Hodgson.
I think Roy Hodgson will be appointed. Started his career, football career at Palace in a different era, obviously, very different era. Lives relatively locally and is eager to take that job on. He presumably will be assisted by Ray Lewington, who was a coach at Palace in the 90s, so he knows the setup there, hasn't changed a lot since then. But then again, Max, if you say that Sam wants to join in February, I'm not going to rule out the fact that he's back at Palace in February either.
How do you think Palace fans will feel about Roy?
Look, I think, to be honest, I think after yesterday's performance, there will be outcry amongst Palace supporters that the majority of Palace supporters, the ball is now gone, because I think the timing just feels weird. It just feels strange. But you have to take into account the disconnect behind the scenes. Roy Hodgson won't inspire many with confidence. But you have to look at what he achieved at Fulham, what he achieved at West Bromwich Albion. West Bromwich Albion was struggling when he took over there, and he kept them safe and solid. And you've got to hope that that is the Roy Hodgson that Crystal Palace are appointing, and not the Roy Hodgson that struggled so much in the limelight, really, when he was England manager towards the end of his tenure with the national team. It's a big ask, I think, for a manager of his age to come into a Premier League job with all the scrutiny that brings you, the 24/7 media coverage and all the demands that places on you, to come in and rescue a situation even after 4 games of the season. So that is a massive, massive ask. But it's something that he is eager to take on. He feels he still has something to offer, and he will see it as a bit of a homecoming because it was his original club.
Thanks for your time, Dom.
Pleasure, Max.
Don Fifield, London Football Correspondent. Barney, what do you make of this breaking news?
It's not a surprise, is it? I mean, I've got a strange feeling reading reading De Boer's quotes at his unveiling, which were really a bit odd, and which involved making various promises and then saying, but, you know, if we can just be in the top 15, we'll be fine. It was a really odd kind of idea. I'm going to do this, this and this, but we're just going to stay exactly where we are. And he sounded kind of oddly ambitious and oddly defeated at the same time. I would say Roy Hodgson, talking of defeated, does anyone think that's a good idea? I mean, the last time I saw Roy Hodgson, he looked absolutely wrung out. I mean, I wonder how he'll get on with Wilf Zaha as well. I mean, that wasn't exactly a...
And Ross Townsend.
Right, yeah, of course. I mean, key players. I mean, it's just a thought. But being from Croydon and having started playing there a long time and knowing Ray Lewington, obviously there's a kind of jigsaw effect there. It seems like you might be a good choice for the job. But I don't know. I'd slightly question that.
Do you think Roy is a good choice, Barry?
He's sort of safe pair of hands, isn't he? I mean, Dominic spoke there about there not being any sort of working relationship between Parrish and De Boer, so I suppose that makes his dismissal understandable. But I thought Palace played quite well yesterday. They should have won. And there's only so much a manager can do. You know, it's not Frank De Boer's fault that Scott Dan missed that header late doors when he should have scored. It's not Frank De Boer's fault that Lee Chung Young played that terrible back pass, although it possibly is Frank De Boer's fault that Lee Chung Young was on the field in the first place, and perhaps shouldn't have been. But then again, that's indicative of Palace's poor recruitment policy during the summer. They made him promises, they didn't keep them. Now he's gone, his reputation must be in tatters at this stage, after the stint at Inter and now this, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what, 150 days between them, the two jobs, something like that.
Although I presume he's made an awful lot of money out of it.
And the strange thing with De Boer, and I have to say, as an outsider, I hadn't really realised this, but even when he was winning the four titles at Ajax, I've been doing research on this for my next book. He really wasn't popular at all. There's all this stuff rumbling on in the background with the Cruyff's revolution and putting Wim Jonk in charge of the academy, and there's lots of sort of philosophical arguments there. And I just sort of assumed, oh, Frank De Boer, you know, played at Barca in the 90s, you know, played for Van Gaal at Ajax in the early 90s, he'd be of that school. And I know that Jonk and Cruyff were sort of fundamentalists for their approach, but there was definitely a sense that De Boer was a bit negative. He's a bit more Van Gaal than Cruyff, I guess, is the issue. And he wasn't particularly popular despite the four title wins.
I'm just interested in you mentioned a book. I just wonder if there's any publication date or what the book
It'll
might
be sometime
about.
Next year, Barney. Don't worry, I'll let you know.
Is there a back catalogue I can go and look up, or any
kind of... if you want to start going through my oeuvre, the first one was Behind the Curtain. Inverted Pyramid might be a good gateway.
Sounds interesting.
Frank De Boer, the shortest reign in Premier League history, apparently. Just taken that mantle from Les Reed. Are you sure about that? So someone's probably been there for
a
day or something.
Steve Coppell have a job somewhere for like 3 hours or something?
Might be permanent.
Is this being sacked rather than being... Because Coppell resigned, didn't he? Because he couldn't... The stress or something was...
Right. Yeah, I think there's a difference between caretakers and
no, I don't think Coppell was a caretaker. I think he resigned rather than being sacked.
He just changed his mind.
Yeah.
Which is surprising, more people don't do that.
That's great. If you're Frank De Boer, you just get a massive payoff for just being hopeless for 4 weeks. How long have I been doing this? let's go to the Etihad. Manchester City 5, Liverpool 0. Barney, you were there. Should we start with the red card? It's, as we noticed, Barry's nemesis, Phil Neville, said it. What did he say? It was a red or wasn't it?
He said it was.
And his brother Gary said it wasn't.
Yes, his family is divided.
This is split people across all nations.
Well, yeah, I was split myself. I've been on a journey with this red card. My initial reaction was kind of like most proper football men, was that shouldn't be a sending off. Partly because I just didn't want it to be one. It didn't seem like a vicious offence, and I knew it was going to ruin the game. But the fact is, it was a correctly given red card. The rules are pretty clear, and whether you like the rules or not, that's what it is. And I actually thought it was a really interesting moment as well, because people treat these kind of red cards as though they're some random act of God, and the game was ruined by this red card. But what actually happened in that moment is Edison did some really good goalkeeping, Mane did some bad play. So like giving away a penalty or missing an open goal, it was to do with the relative strengths of the teams. And City won that duel, and the match kind of followed. What was more extraordinary than the red card was the total supine invertebrate collapse of Jurgen Klopp's heavy metal team, who just disappeared after that.
Do we all agree then it was a red card?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Does anyone think that Mane shouldn't get a 3-game ban because he didn't mean it? Whereas, you know, Britos did mean it.
Well, I think there is an issue with length of suspensions. I mean, what a thing that annoys me repeatedly is when a player who's on a yellow card commits a really bad foul that would normally be a red and gets a yellow, and as a result gets a 1-game ban rather than a 3-game ban. But, you know, on the other hand, what's the alternative? You have a disciplinary committee who sits on every offence and says, yes, that's one, that's two, that's three, that's four. You know, it comes under violent play, that's a 3-game ban.
So, we would be arguing endlessly about the length of bans, yeah. if they did that. It would be even more tedious than arguing about red
and
card.
Yeah, he did kick somebody in the head. Mm. I mean,
The difference between him and Matt Ritchie going for the high ball is that Matt Ritchie kicked the ball. Didn't
well, there's also yeah. I mean, there's also you know, having said that, I think it's a red card. Had it been a yellow, I wouldn't have been utterly outraged, and I don't think anybody would really have noticed. It's one of those that it's. I mean, I think one of the reason why so many people were so sceptical of it is the side of the ground where the camera is, which is the same side as the press box, it doesn't look as bad as it looks from John Moss's side. So when you see the reverse angle, it looks way worse. So when I first saw it, I thought, oh, it's just a bit of a collision. And then you see the other angle and the foot is raised. And it's to do with the pace at which you go in. And I think actually John Moss is in the best possible position to judge just how dangerous that was. And so you accept his judgment. But if his judgment had been it's only a yellow, I don't think we'd really have been that concerned.
Klopp said that City shouldn't get too carried away with this win and Liverpool shouldn't get too sad about this defeat, Barry. But you agree with Barney about this capitulation?
Yeah, Liverpool seem to have got a free pass on this one, as if conceding four goals when you're reduced to 10 men is perfectly acceptable and natural. But it isn't. In Germany, over the weekend, Freiburg, who wouldn't be as big a powerhouse as Liverpool, obviously, in their league, were reduced to 10 men around the same time. They still held Borussia Dortmund to a 0-0 draw. You know, plenty of teams don't concede after being reduced to 10 men. I appreciate that playing against Manchester City with reduced numbers is probably difficult, but it really was a supine, was the word Barney used, and I couldn't agree more.
Well, I mean, managers practice their teams. Well, Jose Mourinho will have his teams practice playing with 10 and 9 men against a full-strength team on the practice pitches. It's a really big deal of being a manager. And I was slightly struck by Klopp during and after the game. I don't know if he's had a very hard transfer window, but he was... I mean, I said this in the paper, he was oddly vague on a few details, which isn't like him, isn't like any man. Imagine Mourinho walking into a press conference unaware that his team are going to play on Wednesday, not Tuesday, and he's got another day to prepare them, which Klopp, he wasn't just a little mistake. He was genuinely surprised to be told that by his press officer. It just wouldn't happen. He'd be out there banging on. He'd have 20 boring, mendacious excuses about why his team lost. But that's part of being a manager. You have to be a maniac. I sometimes think Klopp is just too nice and normal and a bit like you and I to really be that kind of horrible git who wins trophies all the time.
Much has been made of Liverpool's poor defending in recent weeks, but the midfield looked very poor as well on Saturday, and I'd be concerned, you know, the Henderson, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Emre Can, James Milner, is that the stuff that potentially championship winning midfields are made of? I suspect not.
It's sad for Oxlade-Chamberlain to have played 2-1, 0, drawn 0, lost 2-4, 0 against 9. Well, he wasn't on the pitch for all of City's goals. Jonathan, do you want to lavish any praise on City?
Not particularly.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, they played very well, but it was at least as much about Liverpool's collapse. But I think these collapses are becoming more and more common. That big margins of victory in games between top teams I'm sure they're way more common now than they were 10, 20 years ago. So, you know, you think of what happened with PSG and Barcelona last season, that somehow modern footballers aren't able to handle that sort of pressure. Or maybe it's modern tactics, that everything is so much about being on the front foot that as soon as you get behind, you're left with nowhere to go.
So Liverpool just incapable of change? Because you've got to change totally, haven't
you?
Well,
I think they're particularly susceptible if they go a man down as well. I think the way they play, you know, that sort of... You know, it's not about careful positioning. It's not about rigid organisation. It's about overwhelming the opposition. And obviously that's much harder to do when you've got one fewer player.
Particularly the guy who runs around a hell of a lot at the front of your attack and makes it all work. But I mean, before the one thing I really remember from the game before that sending off was a massive amounts of space between Mendy and Otamendi on that left, and a real sense that Mendy, who is brilliant and I think is just a fantastic attacking player, really didn't know quite where he was supposed to be standing in that three-man defence. And Salah, if he was a better finisher, would have, you know, scored. And Guardiola was very kind of, yeah, we won 5-0, but he could clearly see there's problems there, and he'll be working like a maniac with Mendy, I'm sure, to, because that's such a key position for him. And you can see Mendy wandering around, so where am I meant to be now? Well, I'm sure he will learn. He's a clever man as well.
So when Liverpool play their Champions League match against Sevilla, it'll be 10,000 days since they last won the top division. And Manchester City get a fine order in the Champions League. Let's move on to Stoke, Manchester United. Jonathan, what did we learn about Manchester United? Lots of people saying this was their first real test.
I suppose that's probably true. And you know, I think a lot of people felt that those first three wins, impressive as they were significant in that they were the kind of games they weren't winning last season, but didn't actually say a huge amount about how much United have improved. And yeah, they were pretty poor going forward, I thought, on Saturday. That this is a criticism that sort of... I mean, Eden Hazard made it about Mourinho. Eden Hazard, I think, speaking last season about the previous season, saying that Mourinho doesn't really work on structuring attacks in the way that Conte does. And I wonder if it, you know, there is a sort of perception that the game has slightly moved on from... You know, Mourinho is no longer at the cutting edge of the game. And I wonder if that is the element he doesn't do that younger coaches do.
It's stunned to hear that you think having lots of tall people isn't the cutting edge of football. What game are you watching? But there's a weird thing about Man United, isn't it? I mean, well, they've been through all these managers now post Ferguson, but the problem still seems to be the same. This is a constipated team with all this money, all these wonderful players, and it's still the same thing of playing against Stoke and lacking fluency.
Well, there's something lacking strange precision about United generally. If I can refer you to my latest book, which came out 2 weeks ago. how many different managers have won the league with Manchester United?
Not very many, and most of them have been Scottish.
It's been only been... anybody? I'm holding up three fingers. I'm giving you the answer. There's only been three. So from one point of view, the same point of view, Manchester United are the most successful club in English history, having won 20 league titles. But from another point of view... a deliberately provocative point of view, the kind of view you might want to take, Barney.
You're saying you should only get one title per manager?
No. What I'm saying is that the history of Manchester United, given that they built Old Trafford, started building in 1909, was ready in 1910, that gave them a huge economic advantage because it was huge. So actually the story of Manchester United in the last 107 years is one of repeated failure, broken only by two great managers, Ernest Magnell having won two titles before that. So Busby winning five titles, Ferguson 13. Everybody else has failed. It's a strangely difficult club to manage.
Well, who has succeeded under those terms then? I mean, Liverpool have one sort of golden thread. I suppose they had a period in the 20s, didn't they, where they won some titles?
Yeah, but I mean, they did have Shankly, Paisley, Fagan, Dalglish.
Everybody talks about that era would talk about the sameness of it. That's connected.
True. Well, okay, so Liverpool managed to transition better. Manchester City.
Well, you wouldn't say that in the last 30 years.
I suppose
years.
Chelsea. Well, no, they did for 30 years.
Chelsea change their manager all the time, don't they? And they get a league every now and again.
Manchester City have had more different title-winning managers than Manchester United, which is crazy. They've had four, each of whom have won one once.
Barry, I know you don't like it, me just coming to you for the funny things that happened, but did you like Handshake Gate and Mark Hughes and Jose shaking hands with everybody else, but not Mark Hughes?
Well, it seems that Mark Hughes was being quite obnoxious to Jose, which I suppose makes for a pleasant change. Someone being obnoxious to him rather than the other way around. You know, it wasn't that interesting. Jose getting very miffed at being asked about it on BBC was quite amusing, but you know, they didn't shake hands. It doesn't really matter.
Well, see, I don't think it was just a funny thing. I think I don't want to see Mark Hughes pushing another manager. I think it's really serious and you shouldn't do it. Anyone who plays amateur football or is involved in kids' football, I mean, people get very excited. I really don't want to see it. I think it's really out of order and it's a breach of the code of conduct and he'll probably be punished.
Wasn't Jose in his box?
Jose was in his box. I mean, for a start, the box is not there to be ruled on by Mark Hughes. It's the referee's job. He's not the referee. The referee also wouldn't push Mourinho. Standing in his box. I mean, well, there's like there are a couple of gorillas. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. It's like those moments on the tube where you slightly intrude on someone's personal space. So they put their newspaper on your shoulder. I mean, I don't care about his box, but I do care about people pushing each other, which shouldn't happen.
Garth Crooks is trending. Has anyone seen this? Garth Crooks, he's written, "I want to discuss Paul Pogba's new hairstyle, which features a red streak. I mention it because he clearly wants to bring it to our attention. There's so much for the midfielder to do at United, and he still insists on behaving like an adolescent."
What?
Granted, a hairstyle is not going to determine how well he can control a ball or make a pass, but it does say something about where his mind is at the moment. If you're going to attract attention to yourself on a football pitch, do it with goals and performances, not cheap gimmicks and marketing tricks.
I mean, Garth Crooks does know that a lot of footballers have slightly flamboyant haircuts, right?
But I mean, I presume so. He watches a fair bit of football.
And you know,
I'm just the messenger here.
I would say both that Paul Pogba's haircut is less eye-catching than Didier and Dong's, and Paul Pogba is a significantly better footballer than Didier
and
Dong.
Well, that's a very controversial
viewpoint. Less eye-catching than the Keegan Palm, which was a massive thing in its time, and you know,
what haircut did Garth Crooks have?
He just
very straight up sort of.
But
he practiced what he preached. To be fair, there's no hypocrisy there.
Well, the very fact that he took time out to get haircuts rather than play with a huge George Berry style afro.
Well, that might have unbalanced him though.
That his mind wasn't utterly focused on football. He was preoccupied by grooming.
So what Garth Crooks wants is basically that you can only have a great haircut if you've won the Ballon d'Or, and the quality of haircuts, the haircuts can get increasingly ridiculous the worse you get at football. So in League Two would be like a big show of incredible haircuts, and the Premier League should just be
short back and sides all around.
Or maybe this should be suggesting Premier League mandated barber who goes round over the first of every month and just gives everybody grade two.
Well, a panel that rules at what stage of outlandish haircuts you're at. You've got to earn the right.
Who's on the panel, though? Well, Alan Devonshire?
Well, Garth Crooks would be the first name. I like Garth Crooks. I mean, he's a very funny sort of guy. He's a good sort of presence. I remember sitting next to him once at Stamford Bridge, and I was really surprised at how incredibly angry he was about everything. He was very angry about Nani. I remember him repeatedly swearing every time Nani got the ball. Like, I can't fucking believe it. I mean, Nani did leave the club shortly after that, but I was really shocked. I thought Garth would be really, you know, courteous.
But Nani did have a little bit of a curly mullet going on, didn't he? Maybe that was it.
Unearned extravagance.
Has Garth ever worked with Jerry Francis?
Good point.
He wouldn't be able to handle it. He'd be so irate. Well done to Stoke. We should mention them before anyone complains that we didn't mention them. And Choupo-Moting, who's did score twice, so he's allowed the hair that he has. Manchester United play Basel on Tuesday night in the Champions League. Everton 0, Spurs 3. This shouldn't have been as easy for Spurs as it was, Barry.
No, it probably shouldn't, considering the amount of money Everton has spent on new personnel over the summer, but it was remarkably easy for them. And we've sort of come to expect this from Everton, because in their last 8 Premier League matches against, say, what we qualify as the top 6, big 6, they've taken 2 points out of a possible 24. You know, that's really poor. The last time they beat anyone in the top 6, I think, was 4-0 thrashing of Man City in the middle of January. But, you know, Everton go to play one of the teams that finish above them. I always fully expect them to lose, and they invariably do lose. And they seem to have hit this glass ceiling, and Ronald Koeman. I think people possibly thought they would improve this year, but so far they've drawn with City, lost against Chelsea, lost against Spurs, and they're up against Manchester United next. So that in the Premier League, so that'll be interesting to see how that goes.
A stat I've stolen from the Times here: Spurs plus 16 goal difference in the past four away games, 6-1 Leicester, 7-1 Hull, 2-0 Newcastle, 3-0 Everton, is the best such run in the top flight since Sunderland, plus 18 in 1892.
Good side, that.
Was it? Have you written a book about it?
Not yet.
Okay.
a lot of Scots in that team.
But good that Spurs are good away from home, because obviously something about Wembley. They play Borussia Dortmund in the Champions League, and then they've got Swansea at the weekend to banish their hoodoo. How difficult will this Borussia Dortmund game be, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think it will be difficult. Borussia Dortmund have a lot of injuries still. I mean, they were sort of undermined last season by a load of injuries in the autumn. And Marco Reus is out, Schürrle is out, Guerrero's out. There's, I think, about eight players who are doubtful or out. Barry mentioned earlier they only drew against Freiburg despite playing against 10 men for most of the game, an hour or so, wasn't it, on Saturday. So they had started the season pretty well under Peter Bosch, but maybe the edge has just gone off them recently.
Just a little thought on Harry Kane's goal. Mm. Roy Hodgson. That's why he had him taking the corners, didn't he? Just reminded me very strongly of the Euros. Good luck, Palace.
Who's going to... Benteke will be on corners.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. He's brilliant. He's best crosser at the club.
They've got a horrible run coming up, Palace, as well. And I think they've got Southampton. They've got to beat last season's top five.
Yeah.
Hashtag pray for Roy. Leicester 1, Chelsea 2. Who would like to praise Morata? Anyone?
Yeah, he's quite good.
Okay, that's great.
No, I mean, every goal and assist he's recorded so far has been with a header, I think. Mm. So I'm always slightly sceptical of players who come from other leagues with a reputation of being good in the air, because you see again and again that being good in the air in Spain or in Argentina or wherever does not necessarily make you good in the air in the Premier League. So what you need to be good at other stuff. And then you expose Premier League's weaknesses. Premier League is just good in the air. And so if that's all you've got, you get found out. But he does still seem very good in the air.
You're
so
thinking of players like Didier Drogba just exposed as weak and...
No, that wasn't who I was thinking of. I was thinking of Boselli, who was at Wigan. Strakalersi.
It might just be players who were considered good elsewhere, but turned out not to be.
Well, I mean, they were specifically rated for their
area of ability. Dzeko was weak in the air, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, there are examples of players who've succeeded.
Negredo.
That is true.
Negredo faded,
didn't he? I mean, faded really badly. Well, didn't like it up him in the end.
I would say Drogba's no Kevin Davis, though, Barney, just to help Jonathan.
And Drogba took a while to settle, let's not forget that.
Two games, maybe?
No, it took him a year. First season was poor, Drogba.
Yeah. He's toughened up after that.
He was toughened up. And all credit to him for going through that process. Yeah.
Well done, N'Golo Kante, for scoring the slowest 30-yard strike ever. I'm a huge fan of anything that trickles into the back of the net. Chelsea home to Carabag in the Champions League. And that'll do for part one. Coming up in a second, part two. Hey, welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly, which is going to be a bit shorter than I thought it would, because I was going to do Burnley Crystal Palace, but we did that earlier when Frank de Boer got sacked. Well done to Brighton, who scored a goal in the Premier League, scored three of them in a win over West Brom in a game that I didn't predict. Did anybody think Brighton would win this game?
Well, I thought they had a chance. I mean, Brighton... slightly written off, I think, by a few people, but they've got a real spirit, and I kind of will them to do well, as it's sort of a nice club and I like going there. But it doesn't totally surprise me. I think they're one of those promoted teams who might actually have a good run up to Christmas and then see how they go after that.
Arsenal beat Bournemouth. How worried is anyone about Bournemouth, because they have not started well?
Well, I'm not worried about them, but I think they're going to get relegated.
Okay.
Will make no difference whatsoever to my life, but
and that's how it should be judged.
Exactly. If I was a Bournemouth fan, I'd be very concerned. But you know, it's too early to sort of say who's going to get relegated, who isn't, because things can change. Eddie Howe could leave. It's unlikely, but it's possible. New man could come in. But they, you know, it's they're not even looking in any danger of getting a win, and they're not playing well. And Eddie Howe looks like a man who's doesn't really know what to do. So, you know, we shall see.
I mean, to be fair, they have just played City and Arsenal. So there are easier games. I mean, they play Brighton next, is that right, I think?
Friday night, is that one, yeah. Watford are fourth, Barry. You called this win, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I don't really know what to say. I was very confident Watford would win that match, and they did. So I don't look a chump for once, as often happens when I make bold predictions that don't come to pass.
Newcastle won at Swansea. Renato Sanchez, the latest foreign flop in the Premier League.
Do you think he needs to toughen up? I mean, what would you see as the
I think
problem?
A lot of people need to toughen up. I didn't. I saw the highlights of that game. That was all.
You know. Nick Ames wrote an article in The Guardian today outlining just how very disappointing Renato Sanchez was on his debut.
But you can be forgiven. He only turned up on Friday, didn't he?
I mean, he should go back.
I wrote a long preview about that as well, suggesting that this was the second coming of Renato Sanchez, but obviously it isn't. But like you say, he turned up on Thursday. He didn't speak any English or Welsh, which apparently isn't an issue in Swansea, according to Welsh people on Twitter. There's a Portuguese guy in the coaching ranks who's going to be his translator. I think he's someone who's really struggled. He struggled to go to Benfica from troubles across the river in Lisbon. You know, I'm not sure how ready he is for the big wide world, Sanchez. And you do so well, and he clearly should have stayed at his first club. He should have stayed there for two more years.
I mean, I know they're not, but they are similar players. The difference between him and William Carvalho, who seems to be totally unable to get out of Portugal. I mean, are you convinced yet that he exists, Barney?
Well, he's just one of those people, isn't he?
Is he, though? That's the question.
He's just two words someone's put together, and then you feed it into the internet, and everyone's linked to William Carvalho. Amazingly, he didn't turn up at West Ham this time. I mean, there is no William Carvalho.
Brett asks, why are Newcastle portrayed so negatively by the media? It seems only the bad is highlighted.
What does that mean? I mean, I think
that's
most of the media...
typical Newcastle, isn't it? I mean,
most of the media are pretty sympathetic to the position that Ashley's put the club in.
Well, I think two Sunderland fans here, is that a coincidence?
Well, I think if I were even more of a bitter Sunderland fan, I'd be singing Ashley's praises for the job he's doing and ripping all the joy from the heart of that club. But yeah, I have great sympathy for the club and for Rafa Benitez.
West Ham play Huddersfield tonight. And I've written the question, do you think Bilic will be the first manager to go?
No.
Who do you think?
I think De Boer might be.
Really? But he's under a fair bit of pressure, and Huddersfield have started well. Does anybody want to preview this game? Is anyone excited about it?
The one thing I've noticed, and it just seems really weird to me, and I know some people get vexed if I discuss gambling, but Huddersfield are a ridiculously large price to win that match, considering how well they've started, how badly West Ham started, what a shambles West Ham seem to be. And it just makes no sense whatsoever to me how Huddersfield are more than 3-1 to win that game. But after my Watford call, I don't feel as confident about this one as I did about Watford. But just I don't get it. And if someone could explain it to me, I'd really like to hear that explanation.
How much will you be putting on Huddersfield?
That is between me and my conscience.
£5? Play higher or lower? People love games.
Don't look at me, but I do think Huddersfield really fancy this as a game they can win, especially if they start well.
Well, they haven't conceded this season. West Ham only scored twice. So
that horrible... I mean, it's the first West Ham's first home game in this sort of ghost ship that they've adopted in East London, which, you know, lots of people... Well, West Ham fans kind of told themselves it was fine, it would feel like home soon, but it's still a struggle, isn't it? I mean, people have put the best on it. And the whole thing is a strange and baffling mess from top to bottom, and feels like a story which is not finished yet and will probably involve the departure of Slaven Bilic at some point soon, judging by the way everybody seems to be talking about each other.
It's almost like you didn't want to play your cards right there.
I just looked at you blankly for that interlude. I thought I'd talk about West Ham.
Disrespecting the memory of Bruce Forsyth.
Well, I'm not going to get into that again. But apparently he danced his way into our hearts. Is that true? Did he dance his way into your heart?
He's come as close as anybody.
No, I mean, not particularly. Is that bad to say? I mean, he had an amazing career.
Henry Blofeldt retired. Do you know he'd retired from cricket commentating?
I'd noticed, yes.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to have been retiring for about 6 months now, but there was those astonishing scenes as though this man had single-handedly carried cricket on his back like Atlas through the years. I didn't quite get it. I like Brian Johnston. He was good.
I once went to an evening with Henry Blofeldt. I'm not sure why. Two mates were going there to spare a ticket. I went along. It was very disappointing.
Just
a series of really lame anecdotes that weren't particularly amusing. And then his lovely wife set up at a table. And so it's like what I imagine an evening with Jonathan Wilson would be like. Loads of not very good books being sold at extortionate prices.
So just to get this clear.
And trying to guilt trip you into buying them.
Just to get this clear, you're objecting to a series of lame anecdotes being recycled as a kind of professional thing that brings commercial gain.
Yes.
Right.
Quiz question. What links Henry Blofeldt and Lord Byron?
A bear.
No.
Oh.
Crippling addiction to opium.
Perhaps that wasn't what I had in mind.
Buses?
I have no idea.
They have both been the third man out in a hat-trick in a Harrow vs Eton game.
Oh, incredible. Amazing we didn't get there.
I'm sort of sad. I'm a little bit sad that you didn't just wait until we got it. Then the man who complained the pod was too long really be having a terrible time. Right, into the Football League. Cardiff lost their 100% record. The final team in the Football League to hold one, coming from 1-0 down late on to Fulham to rescue a point. 1-0 was the most common scoreline in the Championship. Joint second was 5-0, with both Leeds and Derby scoring that amount, beating Burton, Albion and Hull City respectively. Jack Rodwell scored Sunderland's first goal in three games. Not enough, as they lost 2-1 to Sheffield United, who have now won three in a row and are up to fifth. In League One, Shrewsbury and Charlton are flying. Both picked up good wins. Northampton got their first win of the season in Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank's first game as manager, thanks to a first-minute goal from Matty Crooks, who moved from Rangers in the summer. League Two, Exeter unbeaten. They beat the Vegans Forest Green Rovers 3-1 on Saturday. And Mansfield won 4-1, courtesy of two penalties and one own goal. Port Vale, rock bottom of the 92. They won their first game of the season, but I've lost the other five. Right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll talk to Sid in Spain, look around Europe and have Feedback Corner. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Let's go straight to Spain. Sid Lowe is there, right, Sid?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. So for all the talk that you know that we've had for the past few weeks about Barcelona being in total crisis and meltdown and Real Madrid being flying, Real Madrid held again at home, failed to win their opening two matches at the Bernabeu for the first time since 1995. Do we change the crisis from the Nou Camp to the Bernabeu?
No.
Okay.
And we don't, because the crisis wasn't really about the football, although obviously in the end, if the ball keeps on going in and you keep on winning, then things get smoothed over. I mean, bear in mind that in the first season under Luis Enrique, they called presidential elections basically to try and release the tension and release the pressure on the president, on the club, on the manager, who we all said, and I include myself in this, there's no way he gets beyond the end of the season, no matter what happens. Of course, that was because we never even contemplated the possibility that they'd go and win a bloody treble, which is what happened. And now you're in a position where Barcelona have a four-point lead over Real Madrid. But even as they scored their fifth goal against Espanyol at the weekend, obviously it's a derby victory, so it's significant in its own right beyond just the points, the fans were still chanting for the president to resign. I think there's a recognition now that this goes deeper, that even if they do start to sort it out on the pitch, the mistakes, the way in which it's been handled, the behaviour, the half-truths and the outright lies have been too much now, I think, for people to say, OK, it's fine. Now, that's not to say that the president will definitely lose the vote of no confidence. I don't think he will, because, of course, there's a difference between people whose voices are heard and that necessarily being a majority. But there is a significant percentage, I think, of Barcelona fans who think that no matter what happens, even if we were to go on and win everything, this has to change at institutional level.
I was just about to say that. I mean, I wouldn't want to accuse football fans of being fickle, but how many wins do Barcelona need before the fans go, actually, it's all right?
Well, I genuinely think that they won't think it's actually all right, even if they were to now go and win the league and the Champions League. And obviously on the pitch, they would feel that this is great. But I think it's kind of gone too far in some of the institutional stuff not to still feel the need for some sort of change. Now, obviously, we're all reanalyze and we'll all kind of reevaluate how we look at this if they were then to go on and win absolutely everything. But I think that as well, I mean, apart from anything else, it's very early. Madrid's two draws, you can look at both of them and say, well, you know, they weren't great against Levante, but they were pretty unfortunate against Valencia, and you know, they probably should still have won this weekend. And so I don't think anyone in Barcelona is daft enough to say, this is it, great, we're going to win the league now.
Real Sociedad, three wins from three. They won 4-2 at Deportivo. Is that expected or a surprise as to how they've started so well?
No, I mean, I suppose it's a surprise simply because to pick up three wins in a row, you don't really expect anyone apart from the really big teams to do that. I mean, it's not a huge surprise that back in the last season they were playing really, really well. This team, obviously, who have come off the back of the David Moyes era and improved almost immediately with the new manager playing a very different style of football. So in that sense, perhaps it's not a huge surprise. I guess the test comes this weekend when they play Real Madrid on Sunday night, I think it is. But they are a genuinely good side. They've got a nice, clear approach in terms of how they play. They're very, very good to watch. But I don't think anyone, at the moment at least, is expecting this to last all season long, that's for sure.
La Liga looking into staging regular season games overseas. Mm. Tell us about this.
Well, I mean, the president of the league says that he has already investigated this, that he's looking into it, that he wants to negotiate with the clubs and talk to them about the possibility, because at the very least, he wants to be able to say for sure whether he can do it for next season, as early as that. I think he's talking about a couple of league games for Madrid and Barcelona to play abroad. At the moment, there's not a suggestion that every club would be involved, though, of course, whoever's playing against Madrid and Barcelona would be involved. I'm surprised that this hasn't created more of a shitstorm, to be perfectly honest with you, in Spain. And then at times, I think the quite horrific treatment of fans in this country is partly enabled by the fact that there's a real docility. There isn't kind of a fan's voice like there's been in England in key moments. The way that games are moved around, the importance of TV rights, which all of this happens in England, but not to the extent as here. It's odd that there hasn't been more of a reaction to it. But yeah, I mean, I guess in part because people want to see how this plays out. Obviously, the clubs themselves are surely going to have something to say. They don't necessarily want their players travelling halfway around the world. Apart from the revenue of the game itself, I'm not convinced it necessarily changes things enormously in terms of TV viewing, because I'm not sure that it necessarily, except as being a kind of a one-off watching the game, that it creates a level of interest that's not there anyway. And also, you know, quite apart from anything else, I think it's morally wrong, but, you know, that's another issue, I guess.
Sid, do you think the sort of apathy you speak of from the fans might have something to do with the fact that there isn't so much a culture of away support in Spain, or am I?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And obviously, you know, when I say apathy, there are a lot of fans who are annoyed about it. A lot of fans who feel that there's been a very clear process in Spain as well over the last couple of years since that Deportivo fan was killed before the game against Atletico Madrid, of criminalisation of football fans from the, not so much the police authorities, although of course they're the ones that ultimately have to impose it, but from the league, this idea of stamping out any basically anything that shows any sort, kind of sense of identity, stamping out insults, stamping out banners, even though half of them don't even look remotely provocative in any way. And there's been, as I say, a process of criminalisation, which I think creates a very dangerous false equivalency between football fans having a go at each other in a kind of in a kind of rivalry sort of way, and an actual trouble. And what that's created, I think, is a sense from a lot of football fans that they are just being treated as criminals, and they think they've been treated badly all the way through, and there are some that are fighting back against us, but there isn't a collective voice. But you're right that part of the product of this is that Spain is, generally speaking, a country with a much lower level of away football culture than in England. I think that rivalries often in Spain prevent kind of a collective voice, if you like, amongst fans. I mean, you know, you look at fans groups in England, and there isn't a problem, for example, for Man City and Man United fans to express the same idea in defence, if you like, of fandom as a whole. That in Spain really isn't very much happening. FASFE, which is a very important fans group, is basically ignored completely by the league, has no voice, no place at the table, unlike the Spanish fan groups in England. So it's got a long way to go, and yeah, it's pretty depressing at times, to be honest.
Was there any reaction in Spain to the Premier League's decision to move the transfer window?
Not yet. I mean, there's been the reaction in the sense that it's been picked up on, and it's been talked about as, oh, look, they're going to change this. And of course, the assumption is that this may have an impact on Spain. My suspicion is that the Spanish league and Tebas in particular will think that this possibly gives the big Spanish clubs a slight advantage, because obviously you have longer to sign. You can go and take players off Premier League clubs, for example, and then they haven't got the chance to kind of take one back, and you'll know earlier what their intentions are, and then you'll have time to react to it. So I suspect that he'll probably look at this and think, well, there's a chance that this gives us an advantage, so we'll just stay where we are and let them move it.
Thanks, Sid.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. That news happened just as we finished recording on Thursday. How do you feel about the transfer window moving?
Well, I'm just really glad that the Premier League and the clubs are reading what I write and taking my advice. Well, this is one of the measures I called for in my review of the window. It's obviously a good idea. I mean, the problem with the Premier League is it's just a bit of a mess, and anything that makes it less of a mess is a good idea. I don't think they should worry about not being competitive with other leagues because you get a few weeks less to sign people. The problem is not being competitive with other leagues because you don't produce any players, or the entire team has to be bought.
But there is a truth that, you know, you build your squad and then you could lose somebody and not be able to replace them.
Well, just don't sell them.
Well, just refuse to sell them.
Okay. But then you have an unhappy... But I mean, I know some teams have done it. Does this give the power back to the clubs a bit then?
I think
it depends on how powerful they are at the top.
There will be a lockdown when the window finishes. Clubs will say, that's it, we're done. You're not going anywhere. And players will know that.
Sorry, Barney, sorry.
Sorry.
There's also... If you're a French club and you know that, I don't know, West Brom are interested in your midfielder, and you know that, you know, some mid-ranking Spanish club is interested in your midfielder, you want to sell him before the English window closes, because otherwise that value drops. Yeah, the price is going to suddenly drop at midnight or 5 p.m. whatever the cut-off is, on the date of the English window closing. So you need to get the sale done, because no other country's got as much money. So you can do it if you're in the Premier League.
So actually, the Premier League made that vote and had power to do it because of the money they got.
If another country had done it, it would have been potentially damaging. But the Premier League's financial might is such that they can do it, and other clubs in other countries.
And who
still
voted against it? The Manchester clubs, Palace and Watford, was it? And yeah. Burnley abstained, or something. I think that's it.
Yeah, that's right. I was trying to sort of find some consistent reasoning why people would vote either way, but I mean, I guess you kind of take a view on it. I don't think the Premier League's problem is it doesn't have enough opportunity to buy and sell players. I think that if they want to improve teams, it's probably buying and selling a bit less is a good idea.
And also, this makes it much easier to justify being on holiday when the window closes and missing all that nonsense.
Which is a great idea,
yeah.
Actually. Right, in the Champions League, Real Madrid's home to Apoel Nicosia, Atletico go to Roma, Sevilla, as we've mentioned, they're unbeaten, go to Liverpool. Celtic play PSG, who won 5-1 at Metz. Mbappe scored on his debut. Balotelli scored twice as Nice put 4 past Monaco. Would you like a quirky stat?
Yes, please.
Nantes, 8th, despite only scoring 2 goals in 5 games, which must be exciting for their supporters. Oh, Barry, Italy.
Mm.
You have Italy, apparently.
Well, just Inter, Juve, Napoli have all... still got 100% record. In Serie A, Lazio thrashed AC Milan 4-1, courtesy of with the help of a Ciro Immobile hat-trick. They're managed by Simone Inzaghi. It was Milan's first defeat of the season.
I think it's Ciro.
Ciro.
Mm. I mean, I was sort of telling you so you could redo it if you wanted to.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't trying to, like, dig you out. But we can keep
fine.
It in. All right, fine.
I don't mind. I can
are
do
you
it.
Absolutely certain that's the way it's pronounced?
Well, I've just got a friend.
How do you pronounce those hard bits of bread that you pile bits of tomato and olive oil and pesto on in Italy?
Focaccia.
No. Focaccia is a kind of bread which has stuff. The ones that you put stuff on top of.
Ciabatta.
No, the actual dish. You get a bit of ciabatta.
That's got an H in it.
Yeah, how do you pronounce it? It begins with a B. It begins with a br.
Bread. Bruschetta.
With bruschetta.
Okay.
I've got a mate called Ciro. So, like, my Italian knowledge is poor, but...
But is he English or Italian?
He's Italian.
Is he just putting up with you calling him? You know,
no, because everyone calling...
All right, mate, Ciro. And you, oh, God, they call me Ciro for years.
I don't understand why you brought up bruschetta.
Because everybody mispronounces it.
But it's got an H in it, so it hardens the C.
Well, it's an example of mispronunciation. It's
like
pronunciation,
biscotti would have been a better example.
It's an example of mispronunciation. It's not a direct equivalent to Chiro Kiro.
Jonathan Pierce was calling Morata Morata. And that got me wondering.
Whenever a commentator pronounces a player's name in a really weird, impossible way, you know they've researched it and looked it up, and it's technically correct, but it sounds ludicrous. We don't go around going Paris and Madrid, do you? You say Madrid and Paris.
Barry, Italy.
Anyway, some Milan fans are calling for the head of Vincenzo Montella already. Thank you. I think I'll just leave it there.
In Germany, Hoffenheim beat Bayern Munich 2-0, and one of their goals was scored when there were two balls in play. It was allowed to stand because the second ball was not interfering with play. Ancelotti said we need to read the rule books. Borussia Dortmund, Hannover...
And Kelotti.
Oh, thanks, Jonathan. Dortmund, Hannover and Hoffenheim are the early pace setters, 7 points after three games. RB Leipzig also won 2-0. Timo Werner scored a goal on the break. And Naby Keita scored a lovely goal, booted it in from 25 yards. At bottom of the table, Arsenal's first Europa League opponents, FC Köln, who lost 3-0 away to Augsburg. Some questions from the Twitter. Alexis says, why is Dennis Irwin so underappreciated?
Denny Irwin.
Is he underappreciated? People always say he's the greatest fullback in the Premier League history, don't they?
Yeah.
Could play either side.
What kind of appreciation is he supposed to be getting now he's no longer
what's
playing?
He doing?
A statue? Surely a statue?
A statue of Dennis. Yeah, maybe. I mean, everyone thought Dennis Irwin was really good.
In this age when we're looking to rip down statues for the political beliefs of, you know, of those people... I think Dennis Irwin maybe should be in Trafalgar Square.
We'll replace Nelson's Column with a statue of Dennis Irwin.
Yeah. Do you think in 100 years there'll be some reason to tear it down?
People will be tearing down the Dennis Irwin, saying, well, Ben, actually, he's Ben Davies is eulogised in a popular newspaper this morning and compared to Dennis Irwin as in terms of the acme of an excellent fullback. So I think Dennis Irwin is rated rather than under or overrated.
Was Dennis Irwin very good for being a right-footed left-back?
That's right.
Mm. Well, he could play either side.
He could play either side, but played a lot on the left. Which
he was switched by Ferguson, wasn't he?
Only him and Maurizio Tirico, who probably doesn't need a statue. Tirico. which is a lovely sausage as well. PM UK says, Steve McLaren is famous for his Dutch impression when he was in Holland. What impression will he be doing now he's joined Maccabi Tel Aviv? Sort of Yiddish. James says, after years of pain and shattered dreams, is it safe yet for Leeds fans to start believing the hype around our unbeaten season?
I mean, they're in the Champions League semi-final 15 years ago. I mean, that's not years of pain and shattered dreams. Come to our club.
How's it all going at Sunderland, chat?
Pretty badly, 5 points, fifth bottom.
Nah, you'll be all right. We lost at Barnet.
We're getting beaten by Forest tomorrow night.
Mel says, can we have a weekly slot on Barry Glendening bashing Shay Given?
No.
Okay. Feedback corner?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I think I'd like to start lauding Shay Given.
Okay.
He just seems to be becoming ubiquitous in the media, and I'm bound to bump into him at some point. So I need to stop digging him out at every available opportunity.
Barry, okay. Why do you think Shay Given's so underrated?
I don't think he's underrated.
Do you think it's something about 5'10" Irishmen that we're just going to don't quite appreciate them enough?
You have been calling for a statue of Shay Given for a long time.
Yes, I have.
To go next to...
In Donegal. I think maybe actually going back to the Irwin thing, I don't think he is particularly underappreciated, but he was a very mild-mannered, quiet character. You know, you didn't see Dennis Irwin falling out of popular West End nightclubs or...
I tell you who would have liked his hair. Garth Brooks, wouldn't he?
He's from Cork. And the general vibe in Ireland, the consensus from everyone outside of Cork, is that Cork people are up themselves enough already without being encouraged with extra praise.
Right.
I wouldn't say Dennis Irwin falls into that category in any way, but that could have something to do with it.
Is he not a bit over it? I mean, he's in danger of having that sort of Paul Scholes thing where you mentioned it's like a holy word, isn't it, Paul Scholes? If you were to ever say, I don't really think Paul Scholes is that good, there'd be a riot. You'd be stabbed.
Well, say it. Do it.
Well, I quite like Paul Scholes, but I mean, you know.
Oh, you've backed off. Have a courage conviction,
Stormy. I don't believe it, but I do believe that if somebody did think that, you know, there'd be it'd be utter outrage.
No, you're absolutely right. If you mentioned anything... It would just prove you didn't understand football at all if you mentioned anything negative about Paul Scholes.
Is there anything negative about... Well, I suppose he bottled out of playing for England, didn't he?
A few two-footed challenges.
Well, but he had hay fever, so he didn't play any more tournaments, and he didn't like to be picked on the left.
Asthma, wasn't it?
Betrayed his country. Scott.
Well, with the overrated the hay skulls. Fever and asthma, he could have won the Tour de France riding for Sky.
Think how many people would be tearing down the Paul Scholes statue in 100 years. Feedback Corner, Peter Williams says, I'm enjoying you on the pod, but enough with the below the line chat, which is a difficult criticism because it is below the line that it's come in. So
well, he's complaining that he's you complaining talk too much about...
The comment section.
What, that you talk about it on here or that you go on the internet and talk to those people?
No, no, I talk about it on here. I like encourage the
it's
abuse.
Much more passive-aggressive when you do it here.
Yeah. Lots of people asked why Jakob Kjellberg wasn't on the list of Premier League Jacobs because Jakob has a K in the middle of it and not a C. Yeboah says, I get the impression that it's just dawning on Barry just how annoying Max is. Is that something that just dawning or
no.
You've known it for a while?
I don't find you particularly annoying. I think a lot of people find you annoying because it seems to be, for whatever reason, and it's not often I speak up in your favour, but it just seems to be quite fashionable to find you annoying. But I have noticed the tide seems to be turning. I don't know. You know, you're perfectly adequate at sitting on a thing, reading stuff off a piece of paper, whether it's on TV, the radio... or in near Earth's
well,
orbit.
And let's be honest here, people who sit there and read stuff off a bit of paper and say the odd sort of pun and then say, Barry, any thoughts? Are generally doing something that's not really that difficult, are they? And possibly in danger of slightly overestimating their own importance to any project they're attached to? Is it possible to say that?
It is possible.
I mean, there's a lot of big egos in the media, aren't there? And they come and go, but the pod sales on,
pod listeners are fickle, you know. It only takes a couple of good performances and they're on your side, I'm told.
Personal Space says, I've said it before that I'd love to share a flat with Barry, but at this stage we might as well get married to avail of the tax benefits. Unorthodox proposal, but any chance? This is from Personal Space 69.
Any chance of marrying me?
Yeah.
Get a photo.
There's a chance, I suppose.
Like send a photo in.
Yeah. Try to think if I ever shared a flat, any kind of living quarters with you.
No, you were supposed to share one with myself and the former presenter of this podcast.
Oh, in Vienna, did we not share?
But you wouldn't stay in the room. This was in Vienna because apparently it wasn't good enough, so you insisted on a hotel.
No, I don't remember that.
I remember it.
I don't remember that, no.
I do remember it. Quite clearly.
We mentioned Barry Hales last week, and Interjimbo says, shocked to see Barry Hales, 45, still playing for my local Windsor last month. Played the full 90, but looked well past it. And Spooner Spoiler says, I heard a rumour that you, Barry, once sang on an Irish Sunkissed advert in the early 90s. Please tell me it's true.
No, it's not.
On Monday, we did. We found out how many Barrys, Jacobs and Larses there were in Premier League history. Do you want to know how many Barneys there were?
None.
Not one Barney. Jonathan's. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 18 Jonathans.
18, Jesus.
I know. And a really, like...
None of them any good, surely.
Well, that's amazing. Like,
Jonathan Woodgate, Jonathan Walters, they were both pretty
that's
good.
True.
Woodgate, Walters.
Jonathan Gould, the goalkeeper.
Correct. Do you want to keep going?
Is Johnny Williams a Jonathan?
No. Most appearances, Jonathan Greening. Spectre, Fortune, De Guzman, Hunt, Caleri, Douglas, Parr, Lecco, Groundshog, Blondell, Benteke, Bewers and Franks. Suggesting that Jonathan is perhaps the lowest quality of a footballer going.
Yeah, well, it's a very sort of middle class name, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, that man Lars said the pods go on too long, so thanks Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks Jonathan.
Cheers.
Thanks Barney.
Cheers.
Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.